Culture and Rural Development Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 23rd, 2015. Please let the record state that we do have a quorum. We have six bills on the agenda today, members, so I think we'll get started right away with Senator Dibble, Senate File 1249. Senator Dibble, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate your giving us the opportunity to present Senate File 1249. Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 1249, we are calling the Cottage Foods Bill, and it can probably be better understood as Son of the Pickle Bill. So what it seeks to accomplish, Mr. Chair and members, is to allow people to prepare foods that are considered not potentially hazardous. And there's a definition of not potentially hazard foods in Minnesota rules, and I think I might have distributed to you, if it's in your packet, hopefully it is, how those foods are defined. So it would allow individuals to prepare those foods. These are things like bars and cookies, baked goods, for the most part, those kinds of things, and offer them for direct sale to consumers, either, you know, out of their house or at a farmer's market or some setting like that. And so the specific provisions you can find starting on line 1.4, an individual who prepares food that is not potentially hazard has some requirements of them to prepare and label the food and to display at the point of sale that the products are homemade, not subject to state inspection. Section 2 basically recodifies or combines the pickle bill into this section. It seemed to be everyone's opinion that combining these two, because they're accomplishing mostly the same things for the two different types of food. So Section 2 really isn't a change in law, it's just placing it in a new place. And then some requirements around how the sales are conducted, making sure that the sale is directly to the ultimate consumer for sale at a community event or a farmer's market, from an individual's home to the consumer, but also making sure that we're following local zoning codes and ordinances so that we're not creating shops and stores in people's neighborhoods and the like. Making extra sure that the person who prepared the food, the person who baked the bars or the cookies, is in fact the one who hands the product over directly to the consumer. Making sure that they're not sold outside of Minnesota. They can be sold over the Internet, but still there needs to be a physical transaction. The product has to be put directly into the hands of the individual making the purchase. The cap on the limitation of sales, the cap established for cottage foods is $18,000. Pickles are brought into that same cap. And then there's just some standards to make sure that we continue to provide for the safety of the public to some measure. We're of course not requiring that these producers of these goods rise to the same level as we do of regular commercial producers of food, you know, commercial kitchens, et cetera. But we would like these folks to register with the Commissioner of Health with an annual registration fee, go through some training, safe food handling course approved by the commissioner, and do that every 3 years, making sure that, like I said earlier, they comply with local zoning, local sanitation, public health codes, et cetera. And then we simply establish an account at which the fees for the training and the registration are deposited so that the commissioner can use those for the purpose of administering the provisions of this section. We have two folks here who have done a tremendous amount of work. My constituent, Marion Sussman, who brought this idea to me a couple of years ago, and Kathy Zeman with the Minnesota Farmers Market Association, who has given us a tremendous amount of technical assistance in preparing the final version of this bill. I do have a delete all. I should have said I'm speaking off the A1 amendment.
That's fine. Members were a little, but I think we have it now, the A1 amendment. So Senator Bonhoff was looking for it. Senator Bonhoff would move the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Dibble, to your bill, I guess if your testifiers would just like to introduce yourself and go ahead. Thank you for your hard work on this bill.
Well, thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Marianne Sussman, and I'm here representing some individual cottage food operators of the future. This is a group of women who spend much of their time at home, and they need to make some additional income and they also have a knack for baking. This bill will open the economic doors to my mom and her cinnamon cocoa coffee cake. It will give my differently abled friends an opportunity to be more financially independent. Each of us agrees that food safety is our priority, so the requirement of successfully completing safe food handling training is very good and doable. We also find annual registration and renewals reasonable. The posting of, quote, these products are homemade and not subject to state inspection is a good thing, and we're willing to make that a part of our labeling requirements as well, if so desired. This is not a get-rich scheme or a covert way to get more people hooked on sugar. This is a responsible bill that allows Minnesotans to safely sell non-potentially hazardous baked goods directly from our kitchens to the consumer. Please move this bill forward and recommend its passage through the legislature and on to the governor for signing into law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sussman, for your testimony. Senator Bonhoff, I believe, has a question or a comment.
You can wait to the other point.
Okay, we'll wait. Go ahead, Ms. Zeman.
I'm Kathy Zeman, a certified organic farmer just south of Northfield. I sell my farm products at Riverwalk Market, Fair Farmers Market in Northfield during the summer, and then from my farm shop all year long. I also work part-time for the Minnesota Farmers Market Association in my farm office. MFMA was very happy to work beside many of the stakeholders involved in getting this bill to this point, and we wholeheartedly support it. In particular, we're pleased with three main components of this bill. First, it follows food safety science. In only asking for an increased sales venue for a very limited menu of food, just the non-potentially hazardous foods. Second, we like the fact that this amended bill updates Subdivision 9, the cottage foods, and Subdivision 10, the pickled foods of Statute 28A.15, in the same manner and at the same time, since many of the vendors in the farmers market world sell in both categories. And third, we believe the mandated food safety training specific to cooking food out of your home kitchen to the public and having each food entrepreneur register with the Department of Ag to be a very wise investment for everyone. MFMA spent the past several months collaborating with numerous stakeholders in order to help craft the best bill possible while trying to minimize unintended consequences. We looped in the Department of Ag, the Department of Health, the Minneapolis Department of Health, several of the outstate MDA and MDH delegated authorities, the Minnesota Grocers Association, the League of Minnesota Cities, the University of Minnesota Extension Services food safety team, and many, many of our vendors who sell baked and pickled foods at farmers markets across the state. We believe this bill will allow food entrepreneurs to grow and help build their resilient communities while still maintaining a high level of food safety to the public. On behalf of MFMA and my fellow foodies, I thank you for considering this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Zeman. Thank you for all your hard work. I know that this is not an easy issue, so to bring all those stakeholders together, you guys have done a terrific job. Senator Bonhoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, thank you so much. And we had met before. I had learned about this issue a couple years back and did not do that hard work, so I really appreciate that you did. And I was checking to make sure I wasn't a co-author yet, but it looks like you have some room, so I'd love to be added
sure.
as a co-author.
Absolutely.
And I have a constituent in my community who makes bottled barbecue sauce, and so he's been following this issue very closely. I'm quite sure he would fall under the requirements of not selling more than 18,000. It's just a local thing they do, but I want to make sure that his barbecue sauce would be a food that would be allowable. Is that
Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, that would probably fall under the Section 2, the existing standards for home process, home canned food, if it meets these kind of pH standards and the like. But Ms. Zeman might know better. I know that pickled includes salsas and things like that.
I would concur.
Mrs. Zeman.
But I always defer on these questions to, of course, ag and health.
Okay.
So. And just because I know in this particular case, it's not canned. It is a bottle, but
it's processed, home processed.
Yes, home processed. Sounds like it should be okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
I think under existing regs, but, you know, maybe Mr. Cruz can help. he's hiding behind the column here. He's like, bring the lab scientists over. They can tell us what the pH value is.
Mr. Cruz, welcome to the committee.
Santa Cruz, Department of Ag. And I just have to say that while I applaud all the hard work of Senator Dibble, and we've worked together many times, he clearly doesn't want this to pass, or they would have brought some of the samples of this food that they're talking about. It was kind of an easy win for every vote, for certainly for myself. With regard to the barbecue sauce, it really depends on the process that it's made. It's called the specific water activity level within it. So we would review the process by which your constituent works with it, and we could even adapt it so that it would fit into the bill.
Great.
So we would take that that approach.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And I will make sure to get that information and follow up. He was my youngest son's baseball coach, so we sure want to do what we can for him.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble. Just a couple of questions. I understand if a person is going to be selling these food items, you'd have to be notified the Department of Ag. Is that correct?
Senator
you'd have to be registered?
Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, I think it's the Department of Health. You have to register with the
Department of Ag.
Oh, sorry.
It's A.
Tell someone. Yes, sir.
So with that said, follow-up, Mr. Chair, Mr. Cruz, could you tell me, is there any stipulations when they register from the standpoint of liability insurance as to what's going to be required for insurance for these products that are being sold in case somebody does get injured or something happens to them with these products they bought? Are you requiring any limited amount of coverage?
Mr. Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I do not believe that the bill speaks to the question of insurance. I would think that that would be outside of at least my purview. My best estimate, and I would defer to the author on this, would be that that would be a homeowner's insurance question.
And, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
And I'll just mention that you know, there is the labeling placard that gives consumers some fair warning. These products are homemade and not subject to state inspection. And in the case of the cottage foods, the baked foods, and likewise with the pickle portion, paragraph 2, says these canned goods are homemade and not subject to state inspection.
And I think Mr. Knopf maybe can add a little bit more to that if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, that's the labeling is to kind of warn the consumer that it may not be that this food has not been inspected or that the kitchen's not been inspected, but that wouldn't eliminate any liability from the homeowner who's preparing these foods. They would still be liable, and I think that's something for them to work with through their insurance agents. We do not have anything. There's nothing in this bill that deals with it, but it is something I know I've talked with some of the advocates, and they have been working with a lot of their people to make sure their liability insurance covers problems that are going to arise as a result of this, but the bill itself doesn't address that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dames.
And that's one of the things that concerns me, is this bill does not address it. The Department of Ag is not going to be addressing it. And to just state simply that we need to deal with our homeowner's insurance, if people choose to do that, that's fine. But if they choose not to do that or if they have an exclusion, we're putting people at risk by doing this, and that does concern me. So, therefore, I'd like to make an oral amendment, and I'll let legal decide where it should be put. But I would like to make it an oral amendment that they would be required to have a minimum of $1 million insurance policy in case somebody does get severely sick, that there's some backup there.
Mrs. Zeman?
Thank you. Right now, this is consistent with the current language in 28A.15. In both Subdivision 9 and 10, the cottage and pickle bill, no insurance was required. And so this is just consistent with the former language. However, there are many farmers markets that are requiring both their markets to have product and general liability insurance, and many of the markets are then requiring their vendors to. But at this point, we've allowed it to be the owner's decision, the person that's making the food, their decision is a business decision.
Okay. Senator
Follow up, Mr. Chair, and thank you, ma'am. I do understand that, but I also understand that we're increasing this from $5,000 up to $18,000, and we're opening up some other exposures. So, therefore, I would renew my oral amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would speak against the amendment. You know, I don't know if Senator Dames I don't know where he gets the $1 million, and we certainly don't know that. You know, these are very, very small operators, and this may in fact trigger a kind of premium payment that would just cause this to be not a viable proposition. We're simply trying to do something that's fairly simple, fairly straightforward that many, if not most other states allow folks to do. Clearly there's not been a demonstrated problem. Of how long has the pickle bill been in effect?
Decade.
Yeah. We have the pickle bill has been around for 10 years, and this is not a need that's been identified.
All right. Mr. Knopf, do you have the oral amendment for members?
Mr. Chair, I think we'll just add it to the registration rather than creating a new subdivision. It would be on page 2, line 11, after the period, insert an individual must have a liability insurance policy with a minimum of $1 million coverage. The individual shall provide proof of coverage for registration with the commissioner.
Okay. Further discussion, members, on the Senator Dame's oral amendment?
I just have a question.
Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe one of the testifiers talked about how other states have similar type legislation like the pickle bill and that type of thing, or the cottage foods exemption. Do any of those states require liability insurance?
Ms. Zeman?
To my knowledge, no. I think there's 36 states out there that currently have this, and no one is requiring it. They're all recommending it, but not requiring it, to my knowledge.
Senator Nelson.
Then a second question. I believe I read in the legislation that there is somewhat of a disclaimer that is displayed along with the product so that customers are aware that these are homemade goods and have not gone through the health department. Just clarify that, please.
Ms. Zeman?
Sorry. That is correct on both the pickle bill and the cottage bill. And incidentally, we did ask the Department of Health to run a report, and there has never been a foodborne illness reported from any farmer's market in Minnesota ever. The only one they could find was in 2011 from an Iowa farmer's market that sold guacamole dip. So historically, it's fairly clear that there's very little risk here on these non-potentially hazardous foods.
And then one final question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Senator Dames might consider an amendment to his amendment in light of this knowledge, how other states are treating this, if your amendment were to recommend rather than require.
That'd be fine.
That'd be my oral amendment to the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The word be recommend.
Okay, let's let Mr. Knopf do that, and we'll let Senator Dibble respond. And Ms. Poole, do you have something that you'd like to add? Go ahead.
Yes. Mr. Chair, thank you. Jamie Poole, President of the Minnesota Grocers Association. We greatly appreciate being a part of the stakeholder process here. We are excited about cottage foods and that those are hopefully the next Minnesota-grown products you get to buy on our shelves, so we like to see the industry flourish. With respect to Senator Dame's amendment and recommendation, one thing I would like to add to this is that the $18,000 is per member of the household, so that could add up if multiple people are doing that and become a little bigger production. Not that that always happens, but that is a potential. And the other thing is that we have seen historically with foodborne illness that there is a potential for liability all the way down the food chain. One of the greatest cases right now that's being negotiated through food safety is the cantaloupe incident, where the farmer's insurance ran out and it went back to all the retailers that ended up selling that. So we do voice an appreciation for the dialogue, because we obviously are somewhere along the line selling the products that's going into these as well, so there could be potential liability back. So I do appreciate the conversation about making sure that there is at least recommended coverage. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Yes. Senator Dibble.
No.
Well, Mr. Chair, I very much appreciate Senator Nelson's suggestion, and I support it for the most part, but I'm still curious about the $1 million and the specificity of the level of coverage. I don't know if we could further amend to say an individual is encouraged to have liability coverage without specifying the $1 million that Senator Dames is suggesting, because, of course, we don't know what level of premium that would trigger for these folks who are going to be selling. You know, we don't know that they're going to be selling up to $18,000. You know, that's $18,000 before taxes, remember. And so it could potentially be, it's certainly going to be less that they're taking home, because they're leaving some with the state, and it could be a lot less because they're maybe not even producing that much, and so it could knock them out of consideration.
Okay. Senator Dames.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair. I think we've already agreed to say recommended, and I think with putting that language in there, if we look at incidences, I've been in the insurance business for 26 years, you start looking at incidences, and these things are going to erupt. $1 million is going to be a small drop in the bucket in many cases, but I really don't approve of watering it down any further past than what we have. Well, I think we're saying $1 million is recommended, and that's what my amendment would be, and I would not look at that as a friendly change.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
In that case, I would speak against the amendment.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. just to Senator Dibble's concern, a recommended is permissive, and also $1 million is kind of a standard amount when it comes to excess liability insurance. I do feel that we've given leeway there with the word recommended. Also, I do believe, and Senator Dibble would probably know, I think we've looked at $1 million of coverage for Uber and Lyft as well, just any of these things talking about excess liability and protecting consumers. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
We brought that down off of $1 million in my committee last
week.
Okay.
Senator
Dibble would know. Senator Knopf will, Mr. Knopf will state the oral amendment, and then we'll move towards a vote. Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair. It would be in the same place, line 2.11, after the period. An individual registered under this section is encouraged to have a liability insurance policy with a minimum of $1 million in coverage for personal injury from food, from exempt food sold under this section.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Nelson.
Mr. Knopf, my word is recommended.
That's what I had.
I thought I heard encouraged.
Recommended?
I'm talking about recommended. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call vote.
Okay. Roll call has been requested. A roll call will be granted. Any further discussion, members? We're clear on what we're voting on, though. Dame's oral amendment.
As amended.
As amended.
Senator Sparks?
No.
Senator Bonoff?
No.
Senator Dames?
Yes.
Senator Eakin?
No.
Senator Herr? Senator Coonan?
No.
Senator Nelson?
Yes.
Senator Rest?
No.
Senator Rood?
Yes.
Senator Schmidt?
No.
Senator Weber?
Yes.
There being four ayes and six noes, the Dames oral amendment is not adopted. Members, further discussion. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, can you tell me what the sales or distribution or the sales of raw milk from the dairy producer to the customer, would that be included in this bill?
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, they would not be included in this bill.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, can you explain where I would see that in here? It's not included.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, if you look at food that is not potentially hazardous food, is given a definition defined in Minnesota Rules Part 4626.0020 Subpart 62, and you should have in your packet what that exactly is. And then, of course, the pickle bill down in paragraph 2, starting on line 1.14, defines the products are pickles, vegetables, or fruits having an equilibrium pH value of 4.6 or lower. So that that clearly would not be milk. Do you have this handout?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The rules. So if you look at paragraph C, I won't read it. You can read it for yourself. But that would not potentially hazardous. That definition would raw milk would not fall into that definition of potentially hazardous food that does not include these factors.
Okay. Senator Dames, does that answer your question?
Thank you, yes.
Okay. Any further discussion, members? If not, Senator Bonhoff moves that Senate file 1249 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I just want to communicate to Senator Dames I'm not hostile to his idea. I'd like to continue the conversation. It's just the fact that it was brought up without any prior conversation, and I don't understand the full implications, and I'd like to be able to continue this conversation.
Okay. Fair enough. So, again, Senator Bonhoff moves that Senate file 1249 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next on the agenda, we have Senate File 762. Senator Senjum, I see you sitting there patiently. Welcome to the committee, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I appreciate the hearing on Senate File 762. Mr. Chair and members, 762 basically expands and clarifies the use of the $128 million required sales tax that the City of Rochester is and will impose on it on its citizens as a feature of the Destination Medical Center bill. The bill itself here does two things in terms of expanding and clarifying. The first thing it does, it will allow the sales tax to be used for what we might call administrative and operational expenses associated with the Destination Medical Center Economic Development Unit. That is the group that basically puts the plan together for the development as it's going to occur in the City of Rochester, and that's $5 billion worth of planning. So that does require certainly more than just bricks and mortars. It requires a fair amount of consultant group, study group, and so on, or study effort, and so on and so forth. So this bill would allow then the use of sales tax money for that purpose. The second thing it does is when that sales tax is used, it goes to currently the bill is structured such that 50% of that amount would go towards the credit of $128 million to be spent. This bill would move that to 100% of the credit going towards the $128 million obligation. So that's the essence of the bill. It really does make Destination Medical Center work. It's somewhat technical in nature, but if you're a part of the Rochester City Council or the mayor, it's incredibly important that this bill pass such that the city can move ahead with its obligations. And I would add, Mr. Chair, the city council and mayor are going to be taking up this afternoon the initial, if you will, development plan for the City of Rochester. It's been put together over the course of a year or so now. It's 762 pages long, and that starts at 3:30, and so neither any council member or the mayor is here, but on behalf of the city is Bradley Peters from the Flaherty and Hood firm. And Bradley, if you have some comments, why I'm sure the city would appreciate them.
Sure. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you to Senator Senjum for carrying this bill on behalf of the city. Senator Senjum really did explain it pretty well. It just allows the city to use the sales tax authorization that they already have to pay for some of the administrative costs for the DMC Corporation and the EDA that was set up in statute under the legislation in 2013. It does not change the state's contribution to the DMC plan. It just gives the city a little bit more flexibility in terms of how they pay for some of the necessary activities to make it go.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Bono.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Senjum, I'm looking at the effective date section, and I've never seen any wording like this in any of our bills where it states that it's effective the day following compliance by the governing body of the City of Rochester. And so I'm wondering if council could explain how we control that. It seems then would that happen following the House, Senate, and the governor signing this bill, and then it would have to then be adopted by the governing body of the city of Rochester. Could you shed some light on that?
Mr. Fuller? Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, in local law, we have a statute that governs how they become effective. And there's some exceptions when you need legal or local approval. Give them a power they don't otherwise have. I assume this does not fall within one of the exceptions. And so, therefore, you need local approval. And this is the boilerplate language you use for local approval. Making it retroactive is the choice of the legislature. You can make laws retroactive. I assume if there's some intervening rights that could be impaired, that would be an issue. But I assume that's not the case. So it's not every day we do this, but we do it occasionally if it suits the purpose of those who are, you know, authorizing the legislation, which it must do here. There are past events that they want to have covered by this provision.
And so, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fuller, back to the question of then when would they be able to begin that retroactive process? Would it be after it's passed by the House, Senate, and signed by the governor?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonneville, that lines 4.19, it says they're effective the day following compliance with the local government with the requirements of this, and then they're effective retroactively. So I assume the city will act fairly rapidly to do this.
But again, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fuller, we would still have to pass the law for them to be able to have that right.
Mr. Chair, yes, this bill would have to be signed into law.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Senjum. Glad to be co-sponsoring this bill with you. It is an important piece of legislation, and I do want to just make clear to the committee the local sales tax has been approved 3 times by Rochester voters. This does simply keep the $128 million, which is the cost that Rochester voters are going to be required to pay for the Destination Medical Center project at $128 million. Without this piece of legislation, it would be $128 million plus the planning costs that are included in the second part of this bill.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any other questions for Senator Senjum or the witness? If not, Senator Nelson, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, I'd like to move Senate File 762 be recommended to pass, Mr. Chair, and sent
to taxes, I believe.
Tax Committee.
Okay. On the Nelson motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We do appreciate it.
Okay. Next on the agenda, folks, we have Senate File 779. It's a Senator Sieben bill. However, Senator Schmidt is going to be presenting the bill as a co-author, as Senator Sieben is not able to be here with us today. So Senator Schmidt's going to be pinch-hitting on Senate File 779. Senator Schmidt.
Mr. Chair and committee, I'm happy to pinch hit for Senator Sieben today. She did have a conflict. We do have an A1 amendment that I'll be offering here in a moment, but I do have a statement that Senator Sieben had prepared I'd like to read regarding the bill. I'll proceed here. Senate File 779, as introduced, established a paid parental leave program for all Minnesota employees. As Senator Sieben began discussing the language with stakeholders and agency staff, it became clear that more work was needed to be done to ensure the program is designed with care and, most importantly, designed in a way that works for Minnesota employees and employers. So today, we are offering a delete-all amendment that requires deed in consultation with the Department of Labor and Industry and the Departments of Health and Human Services to provide an analysis of the most efficient and effective mechanisms for implementing the program. We're also requesting that their analysis built on the originally paid family leave proposal by considering paid medical leave, which would allow employees access to leave to care for themselves when seriously ill. Minnesota is a national leader in women's workforce participation. While the number of working mothers has declined nationally in recent years, in Minnesota it has increased from 74% in 2000 to 79% in 2011. In order to maintain this high participation level, we need to create policies to support working families. We know that women who have access to paid leave are more likely to continue working after they have children. The Minnesota Department of Health also recently released a white paper outlining the many health benefits of paid leave. Senate File 779 directs DEED to work with Department of Labor and Industry and Health and Human Services and stakeholders around the state to include paid leave options and submit a report to the legislature so we can determine the best way to move forward. With that said, we have several testifiers here today that would like to speak in support of this legislation, starting with Peggy Flanagan from Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota, and representing Minnesotans for Paid Family Leave.
Mr. Schmidt, maybe, or Senator Schmidt, while she makes her way up, do you think it would be appropriate to
let's move the A1.
Move the amendment to get the bill in front of the committee members so they know? Members should have the A1 author's amendment in their packets. Senator Schmidt would move the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would prefer. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Peggy Flanagan, Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, and a member of Minnesotans for Paid Family Leave, a new and growing coalition of faith, labor, and nonprofit organizations. Thank you for allowing me to testify on this important legislation, and thank you to Senator Sieben for her leadership on this issue and bringing forward this bill, and for Senator Schmidt for pinch hitting today. Children's Defense Fund's mission includes getting children off to a healthy start in life. What better way to ensure that than to help parents afford to take the time they need to bond with a new baby or care for a seriously ill child? Parental leave is shown to improve mental and physical health outcomes for new mothers, facilitate involvement of new fathers in their children's lives, and have a positive effect on family economic security. A growing body of evidence shows that children's cognitive and social development may be enhanced when parents have paid leave too. Leave time establishes attachment between a parent and child. It is a major factor in the duration of breastfeeding, which has benefits for both mother and child. And paid leave helps to ensure that parents make it to well baby doctor visits and that we know are such a critical part of the preventative health care of a child. Additionally, parents who are able to take paid leave to care for children of all ages with special health care needs report better outcomes for their kids. Earlier in the month, the Minnesota Department of Health released a white paper underscoring the link between paid leave and health. It made clear that because of the significant effect of paid leave on the health of our children, families, communities, and state, it shouldn't be a nice to have, it should be a must have. Unfortunately, the report also showed that far too many parents are going without paid leave, and that those who are least likely to have access are those with lower incomes, part-time workers, and single parents. They're often populations of color and American Indians, like myself. The lack of paid leave among these populations mean that these children face an even steeper ladder of success in the very beginning of life. As an advocate for all children, including the 400,000-plus children living in poor or low-income households in our state, this disparity is cause for concern and must be addressed. In closing, I'd like to highlight how this year's legislature has spent a lot of time on debating early childhood policies, especially those targeted to children in lower-income families. That's because lawmakers recognize the critical importance of these early years to creating a strong foundation that supports a child's future success. Implementing a family leave program is a significant way that lawmakers could help all children, including those growing up in low-income families, get off to a strong start and healthy start in life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Flanagan. Any questions for the testifier? If not, thank you very much. And then, Senator Schmidt, do you have a few more folks?
We have a couple others. If Ms. Clayman could approach the witness stand, and also Reverend Amy Jo Burr.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and whichever one of you wants you to go first, just please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Nikki Kleeman, and I'm a leader with Isaiah. I'm here today as a mother who knows firsthand how important paid family leave is. My husband and I have three children, a 5.5-year-old daughter, and 3.5-year-old twin boys. Our son Mason was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia shortly after his second birthday. He was hospitalized and then homebound for almost 2 months. The only time he was able to leave the home was for doctor's appointments, bone marrow biopsies, chemotherapy treatments, and hospital stays. Due to treatment, he's left with no immune system, which means that he can't be in a daycare setting if his health doesn't allow him. Last year, I was introduced to Momcology, a support community for mothers of children who have been diagnosed with cancer, and I was lucky enough to attend one of their national retreats. I formed relationships with mothers whose kids were diagnosed with cancer or leukemia, and time and again, I heard heartbreaking stories of parents who were financially devastated by their child's illness. They lost their homes, their insurance, and gave up everything to take care of their child. On top of medical bills, many parents have to miss pay that their families desperately need to be with their kids through hospitalizations, procedures, and recovery. I've also heard from parents that were fired or had to quit their jobs because their employers would or could not give them the time they needed to take care of their kids. That's where I met Teresa Nace. Her daughter, Adeline, was diagnosed with retinoblastoma, or cancer of the eye, at just 9 months old. She wasn't able to return to daycare until her 6 to 7 months of treatment was completed. Teresa became her full-time caregiver, and the medical bills started piling up. When Adeline was able to return to daycare, Teresa was able to obtain a new job. Adeline became sick shortly after, and Teresa asked for some time off of work. This is what her employer told her. If you were more senior in the company, we could help you with your child with cancer. We can't help you at this time. Teresa was not yet qualified for FMLA and was worried that she would lose her job if she took time off for doctor's appointments or hospital stays for her child. Currently, there's no protection for situations like Teresa's, and the system is failing those that need it most. As parents, our primary commitment is to protect and care for our children. We should not be forced into impossible choices between earning money our families need to survive and caring for our children as they face life-threatening illnesses. That's why we are working to pass paid family leave so that working parents have the support that they need to take care of their families. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Clement. Any questions for the witness members? Reverend, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm honored by the opportunity to testify before the Senate Jobs Committee today regarding paid family leave in Senate File 779. My name is Reverend Amy Jo Burr. I reside in St. Peter, Minnesota, beautiful town, about 90-minute drive from here. Come visit. I serve as pastor of Good Samaritan United Methodist Church and La Centra United Methodist Church, working with Isaiah. Relevant to my role in today's hearing, I hold a Master of Divinity degree from Emory University, including graduate coursework in ethics and pastoral care. I speak today to remind us of the faith values that bind community together and the ways in which a public policy of paid family leave can support those shared values and then strengthen our communities. As people of faith, God calls us to love abundantly, to love as God loves us, and the way that God loves us is as family. When people of faith begin our common prayers with words like Our Father or Loving God, Mother and Father of us all, we're calling on a God who teaches us by example how to love family with abundance. In God's family, we share a belief that every person of every age is made in the image of God. This belief supports and strengthens our commitment to basic human rights for all people. In God's family, we also share a value that the most vulnerable amongst us is the most beloved, that God cares especially for the hurting, the lonely, the sick, the oppressed, and so do we. When we care for our loved ones through the crises of sickness, through the frailty of the end of life, and through the joy of childbirth, we are loving our families as God has taught us. These values of caring for the most vulnerable strengthen the entire fabric of our communities. As people of faith, we're dedicated to seeking public policy that nurtures every person and allows them to live and love abundantly. As a mother, I was blessed with paid family leave after the birth of my children, so I could care for them during the first few weeks of life. The recent Health Department report explains the positive health impact of this. But I'm grieved to tell you that's currently not what is happening with most Minnesotans. Currently, thousands of Minnesotans without paid family leave are being faced with the impossible choice of caring for loved ones or going to work to make the mortgage payment and medical bills. At a public meeting with our legislators held in St. Peter this past weekend, several people of faith shared their stories, much as the story you've just heard today, of pain regarding feeling financially forced to return to work when they were greatly needed to care for their families. The stories included a father given only 1 week of paternity leave who therefore returned to work while his newborn twins were still in the neonatal intensive care unit, a father whose own health suffered and found himself in substantial financial debt after attempting to care for his ill wife and their newborn twins with inadequate leave from work, and a mother who was given only 3 weeks of unpaid leave to bond with her newly adopted son. As a pastor, I often visit in the hospital rooms of critically ill parishioners whose family have been at their bedside throughout the night and then go to work sleepless because they don't feel they have the option of missing a paycheck. We can change this, beginning by passing a paid family leave law so that Minnesotans will not be forced to choose between caring for our families and working to provide for our basic needs. Together, we can support the families of Minnesota to care for one another and to live out the values of faith that strengthen our communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Reverend. Any questions for the witness?
Mr. Chair, we do have one more witness who would like to come forward. Vern Severson.
Okay. Mr. Severson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Vern Severson, a resident of Jordan and owner of Forward Pay Systems, a small Minnesota business based in Eden Prairie. I pay my employees for sick, family, and personal leave time. For me, this is a matter of justice, family values, and the success of my business. As a Christian, I'm motivated by my faith to work towards justice for all people, and I'm also committed to help build a Minnesota economy that is just, healthy, and robust. Justice to me means freedom to make life and value choices without fear of losing pay or employment. All employees should have the freedom to care for their loved ones in medical emergencies and in dying situations. All employees should have the freedom to take a few weeks to bond with their newborn or adopted child. But I'm also motivated to work towards the success of my own business. I need my employees to be at their best. Employees are at their best when they can stay home when they are sick or they need to care for their families. This way they can get better faster and they don't spread their illness to other employees. And they're committed to their work because they know they are treated with dignity. However, many small business owners like myself who do or want to provide paid leave find ourselves at a competitive disadvantage to those businesses who do offer paid leave. If paid family leave becomes law, all small business owners like myself can then offer 6 weeks of paid leave. The maximum cost for employers is $78 per employee per year, or $6.50 per month per employee. This is absolutely manageable. As a small business owner, I can pay this minimal amount to ensure the dignity of my employees and realize tremendous productivity. Considering the growing number of corporations these days that do not provide benefits, paid family leave legislation is a necessary solution. There should be bipartisan support for paid leave legislation. We need to look carefully at the motivation of those who are working to prevent these common sense solutions for Minnesota families and Minnesota businesses. With paid family leave, Minnesota business can have healthy, productive employees that will result in a Minnesota economy that is just, healthy, and robust. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Severson. Questions for the witnesses? Sir Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I really appreciated the testimony and definitely understand the importance of parents being able to stay home when their children are sick. I've sponsored some of that legislation in the past regarding caregivers' support. But my question, it might be for Mr. Severson, or it might be more for Senator Schmidt. And so the employers realize how important it is that their employees are productive while they're at work, and that's why many employers, just like yourself, offer sick leave, paid sick leave. Mm-hmm. But some do not, and I understand the comment that you made regarding those who are providing paid sick leave then are at a competitive disadvantage with those employers who might not be offering that benefit. And my question, and I think I understand that competitive nature, but the fact of the matter is commerce doesn't stop at our borders. And so what I want to know is, are there any unintended consequences of this very well-meaning piece of legislation? Not saying that I disagree with it, but I just want to know about any potential unintended consequences, which would be, Senator Schmidt, making us uncompetitive, at least with those states that are nearest us. But, of course, a lot of commerce does not even drive across state lines anymore. It's a click of the mouse. And so my question is, how many other states have legislation like this? We don't want to make Minnesota an outlier is where I'm going with this. So how does this proposal, and maybe it's a question for Senator Stevens when she comes back, but how does this proposal compare with other states' similar proposals?
Mr. Severson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I've thought a lot about that. And the way I see it is that if all Minnesota businesses can offer paid leave, the productivity of our employees are going to be so much better that our Minnesota economy is going to be better. And I guess I feel that puts our state at a competitive advantage to other states. So that's my take on it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that, I think that's why we're proposing a report here and an additional study, is to get more information on what was originally proposed and what we might be able to bring to the table next year following completion of the study. I think as we look at the 21st century workforce, I think there's much more interest in workers of today in striking that work-life balance, and I think this goes a long way, as you heard from our testifiers, in terms of trying to meet the challenges of working parents, today and here and now.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
And so I do appreciate the report. I noticed that piece of the legislation. And I also appreciated the comments on the cost. We always need to weigh what the cost and what the benefits are of what we propose. And I do see that in this legislation as well. And I was particularly intrigued with the $78 a year. Is that in? I think that is a number. I think many were scared. We didn't know what that cost was. And so is that in the legislation, that it's a maximum of $78 per employee per year?
Senator Schmidt.
Chair Sparks and Senator Nelson, we do have a delete all amendment in front of us, and so we have language that was in the first bill that was introduced, Senate File 779. That's not on the table today with the adoption of the delete all. So we're just talking about the study here today. And so, I could talk a little bit about the success that these sorts of approaches have had elsewhere. In California, there's been a paid leave program in place for over a decade. And more than 90% of businesses surveyed reported either positive or no noticeable effects on profitability, turnover, and morale. 87% of businesses cited no increased costs, and 9% cited cost savings as a result of the program. So what we're trying to do is have an eye towards competitiveness and also recognize that there are new challenges facing working mothers and fathers today that might not have been recognized in the past.
Senator Nelson.
My last comment. So we do know that employers do this voluntarily because of the very productive and increased production capacity that Mr. Severson mentioned. And I know that Senator Schmidt might not be able to accept a friendly amendment on a bill that's not his, but my suggestion would be that the report actually includes something about how this impacts Minnesota's competitiveness with other states. And so I would... I guess I will not offer that amendment here since it's not your bill, but as the bill goes forward, I think that's important that we look at how would this impact Minnesota's competitiveness with other states. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Nelson. I think that's a good point as well. Senator Deems?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the first question that I have would be for Mr. Severson. And Senator Nelson kind of touched on this $78 a year, $6 per month, but if Mr. Severson could tell me where he's getting that number from.
Mr. Severson?
I got that from some people at the Isaiah group that had been working on this legislation.
Okay.
Is the original? It was in the original legislation.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add, this was in the original bill, but we're not debating the original bill today. I mean, we're talking about the report that we're asking for here. And so, you know, that's a number that was derived, but again, it's not in front of us in terms of the A1 amendment.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, thank you for follow-up. I understand that, Senator Schmidt, but if the number is going to float around, we need to know, even though we're looking at a study, we know what the ultimate results of a study it may or may not be, but if it was in the original bill, where did it come from? How was it derived at?
Mr. Chair, Senator Daniels, you know, I can't speak to that pinch hitting here
what
today.
I need to know.
I hope you understand that. But we're asking, you know, specifically in this report that is now Senate File 779, estimated timeline for implementation of the various mechanisms and approaches, also cost estimates for each of the following types of leave that are identified in the A1 amendment. So we're trying to hone in on the costs and be able to come back next session with more certainty on what's being proposed.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Schmidt. I understand that this is going to be a study, but if we go to page 1, line 118, I also understand that very likely, well, if this is a law, then the employers will be required to participate. And if the employers are going to be required to participate, I'll get that out eventually, I'm not so sure we should be calling it an employer contribution as much as we should be calling it an employer tax. So I just want to point that out. I think the employee would be a contribution, but I don't think the employer. I think it's another tax on the employer, and I just want to point that out. That's my comment.
Mr. Chair, we may have some testimony to speak to that prior question, too.
Well, okay, I'm just going to allow us to be real brief, though, because I think we are. I think the testifiers maybe worked a little bit to lay their foundation, but we are talking about a study here, so we're getting a little bit off in the weeds. But if you'd like to respond briefly, please state your name for the record.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Jessica Anderson with Children's Defense Fund. The $78 number, that came from, we did a fiscal analysis with the Minnesota Population Center, and that was the number that was come up with. That would be the amount required in order to self-fund the program. So $78 was the maximum amount that an employee and an employer would have to pay per person.
Does that help, Senator Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chair. Davis. Yes, I understand where it came from. I was hoping to hear that it had either been done by one of the agents or MMB, but that's fine. I know where it came from, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Okay. I believe that's the end of your testimony, Senator Schmidt. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 779? If not, any questions for Senator Schmidt before we entertain a motion, members?
Well, Senator, seeing no questions or discussion, I would move the Senate File 779 as amended for passage.
And it needs to be referred to the Finance Committee. Any further discussion, members? On the Senator Schmidt motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Schmidt. Thank Senator Rest? Senator Rest, we have Senate File 1456. Senator Rest, whenever you're ready, go ahead.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 1456 is a bill that sets up what is called in the legislation the Historic Preservation Corps. And the characteristics of that core very similar to another one that was established a number of years ago, but it does provide that it is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation that provides some on-the-job training and workforce development specifically related to repair and maintenance of historic structures. It's fairly straightforward in who it's intended for and the conditions under which these mostly young people are employed. There are provisions that make sure that since it's for, God bless you, since it's for these projects or for a limited time, the people that are employed by the Historic Preservation Corps would not be granted unemployment. They're also, and this has been a subject of discussion, and I'm sure will continue to be, they're also not covered by prevailing wage contracts. However, just as in the Conservation Corps, the employing state or local agency, if you look to lines 118, subdivision 3, is intended to make sure that people working in these training jobs are not supplanting the jobs of currently employed workers, workers on seasonal layoff, or in any way seen to reduce the number of hours that otherwise permanent or seasonal employees would have. We do have people here to comment on the proposal, and if you'd like to hear some testimony, or they also are available to answer questions. In addition, Mr. Fuller, thank you very much, Mr. Fuller, pointed out earlier today that there needed to be some parallel structure in the bill, which didn't exist now. It's just a grammatical change to make sure that the provisions that need to be parallel indeed are parallel. And so, Mr. Chairman, to that end, I would offer the A3 amendment.
Okay. Members should have the A3 amendment. Senator Rest will offer that as an author's amendment. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted.
Senator Rest. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Actually, it wasn't an author's amendment because this is the second of the committee. But I think I did explain it ahead of time. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, if you would like to hear some testimony, we have it available.
Sure. You proceed however you want, Senator Rest. It's your bill. So if you'd like to bring those folks up for a little bit, they're more than welcome to say a few words.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Keller here is here from the Historic Society.
Okay.
So with your indulgence, just a few brief words about the project.
Surely. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Rolf Hagberg. I'm the Executive Director of Northern Bedrock Historic Preservation Corps. We're pleased to be here today. This is a partnership that has grown out of the need to do maintenance and repair on historic structures. The State Historic Preservation Office estimates that there are over 7,000 properties listed on the National Registry in Minnesota, in over 50,000 historic structures and landscapes that are all in need of repair and maintenance and work done on them. On the other side, there's a diminishing pool of technical experts that understand how to do this. It's an aging pool of crafts and tradespeople, and we have partnered with the Minnesota Historical Society to create a Conservation Corps type program to bring young adults into this, to encourage them and give them experience in working with the trades. We have been talking with the construction and trades unions about. They see us as a pre-apprentice type program where we'd be able to get young people hammers in their hands and trowels in their hands and give them some experience to do this. So the language that's here is are great tools for us to be able to do the training. We will need to be able to find jobs and opportunities for them. Many times if they're on a work site, they will just be in a training mode and not performing a prevailing wage type of service. So that's a part of the reason we need the exemption. But
thank you very much, Mr. Hagberg. Any questions for the witness or Senator Rust?
Mr. Chairman, I would point out that this is a late bill, and it, if the committee acts favorably, it needs to go to the Rules Committee.
Okay. Well, Mr. Fuller, would you like to add that?
Mr. Chair, that they'll happen by rule, so the motion would be to recommend it to pass.
Okay.
And then we get to the floor.
And then
they do their magic.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
All right, that's fine. But thank you for the clarification.
That's what will it is a late bill, and that's what will happen to it upon a motion to pass.
Okay. Sarah Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a very quick question that perhaps Senator Rest or maybe Council can answer. And I noticed that this specifically does not apply to Historic Preservation Corps. As defined by Section 138.935, and I think, Senator Rest, you might have referred to that it's not a similar type core. And I'm just wondering, what is 138.935,
which is some sort of... Mr. Chairman, what page are you looking at?
Page 2, lines 11 and 12. And I'm just wondering, which Historic Preservation Corps does this not apply to?
Mr. Fuller?
Well, Senator Nelson, it would apply to no other than what's cited. And I'm not sure there are any other, but it only applies to the one that's cited.
Well,
Senator Nelson?
Mr. Chair, my question is on page 2, line 11 and 12. It says this section does not apply to a Historic Preservation Corps as defined by Section 138.935.
Right.
Okay. That's section
one. On page 5, it also... lists a new criteria, number 36, non-covered employment, which, of course, we talked about that already.
Unemployment.
Yeah, we already talked about that. But I was just wondering why it doesn't apply.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Fuller, maybe?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, it takes it out of the prevailing wage law.
Okay. Thank you. That's just the reference I was looking for.
Okay.
That's what makes the bill so long.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Rest said that. I just didn't tie it to that reference. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Any further discussion? Then Senator Rest would renew her motion that Senate File 1456 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you very
much.
Bill
is passed. Thank you, Senator Rest. I think if it's okay with members, Senator Wieger's been waiting patiently. Maybe we'll let him present his bill, and then I'll go last if that's okay. So, Senator Wieger, you have Senate File 714 before the committee. Senator Wieger, welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate File 714 is the Creative Freedom Act. And it's inspired by Bob Knepper, a constituent from North St. Paul. Mr. Knepper, to my right, is a retired inventor, worked for a major corporation for over 30 years. He's authored or co-authored several patents, and he has been involved on this issue for nearly 50 years and has helped write some of the statutes addressing intellectual property. And basically this gets at what is done with an idea, a proposed invention that you may propose to your employer. Employees want to see their ideas actually implemented, but if it's not implemented, that idea, then
that there be the freedom for that employee to use it. And there's exceptions, and we have this apply to veterans to sharpen focus. But with that introduction regarding the overall purpose, I'd like to ask Mr. Knepper to address the committee on his efforts and why it's needed.
Wonderful. Mr. Knepper, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm here to appeal for creative freedom. We don't have the freedom you think we might have. Major industrial employers often require that their employees surrender their civil rights to virtually all inventions 24/7 as a condition of employment. That's actually part of the employment application. State law prohibits firms from claiming that totally unrelated inventions. In other words, the company can't claim things that are totally outside of the business. The missing obligation to either use or return gives the employer awesome power to claim and then shred unrelated and often unwanted employee inventions to keep employees focused on assigned tasks only. This common practice blocks the development of many new products, new businesses, new jobs, and tax revenue. It also runs counter to the intent of the U.S. Patent Office, which is these companies are suppressing inventions rather than stimulating them. I'd like to read one sentence out of the United States Constitution that is being violated in my mind. It says, Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. That's really clear. However, that doesn't go on in normal life today. Our proposed Creative Freedom Act requires employers to simply use or return all of the employee inventions that they claim. Now, that makes a lot of sense, but it doesn't happen. Minnesota economy cannot afford this potential heavy loss of assets if we want to be globally competitive with full employment. Initially, this measure covers only military veterans to make it easier to pass, and because veterans are most deserving, I think, having risked life and limb defending all of our civil rights, but now they're being denied them. That's over and above. Veteran unemployment rates are often double the civilian rates. The intention would be to expand this coverage to all Minnesota employees once proven effective with the veterans. This measure exempts the firm's main product line, so it's only pertaining to things that aren't interested for this particular. Let's suppose you're making cars and you came up with a new door closer. Well, they're not going to be interested in that, and so we're going to have them release it. It can be very important to the employee, but it's worthless to the company. So that's to keep overly creative employees, like myself maybe, from forcing the company to accept and install a whole new production system that would disrupt the production. So we've exempted these type of inventions. It also allows the firm first chance at developing unrelated inventions. We're giving the employer that benefit. They're probably not entitled to them, but they have a chance to do it. But they can no longer sit on them or shred them and stop them. This is very, very important. Just one invention can be very, very important. You don't need very many inventors to make an awful lot of difference. I always cite one in here, the development of the Xerox copier. That's a fantastic story. And the reason it did get released, the company didn't produce copy machines. And so this employee came up with this invention, and he says, hey, I'd like to have a release on this invention because I don't think you're going to develop it. So he said, well, let's see your demonstration if you've got a new copy process. So he brought in his cat's fur and wax paper and stuff that he did to demonstrate the very principle. And of course, it didn't show. It didn't come out very good. He couldn't get copies that they could read. And he says, "Give me that release." And so he signed it off in disdain of this worthless invention. But now, once this thing was signed off, now he could go and search for somebody to develop it. And he went to 27 different companies that all turned him down, including 3M and IBM and RCA, and all these companies turned him down. And then IBM first turned him down, and if it's not good enough for IBM, it's not really good for the rest of it. So he had a hard time. But he finally found a company that was interested in physics of handling little particles of dust, and another company that was losing they had a product like carbon paper that was going obsolete, but it was an office business. And they put a lot of money in it, and finally, after I think it was 25 years or so, they finally got it made. And then this worthless company grew into a $50 billion industry, and it created 500,000 new jobs. One big invention. And then it got so big that the federal government had to break it up. And I discovered that because they offered me one of Xerox's patents to use at 3M when I was there. So I'm very interested in that. I researched it because I worked on the design of copy machines. In fact, I was a project engineer on the world's first color copier. Very exciting project. Okay, passage of this measure promises the following permanent benefits. Employers will develop more inventions for fear of losing ownership to them. They got 6 months to make up their mind whether they're going to invest in it or not. And secondly, employers would submit more inventions, knowing that the employer could not stifle them. And thirdly, employees would regain their civil rights to own inventions, but only after the employer had rejected or abandoned the new invention. The above factors would cross-stimulate each other and thus provide a permanent supply of new inventions, new products, new business, new jobs, and tax revenue, all at no cost. We're not asking any money. So it's just give us more rights to build new products. Any questions?
Mr. Knepper, thank you for all your hard work on this Creative Freedom Act. Any questions from members? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Knepper, I agree with what you said. Veterans are the most deserving. And are you a veteran?
Yes, Mr. Knepper. That doesn't pertain to me because I'm not on one of these anymore.
Senator Nelson.
No, Mr. Knepper, I just want to thank you for your service and all of our veterans. They are the most deserving. And I also relate to your comment about our veterans' unemployment rate. It is significantly higher than the unemployment rate in general in this state. And I've authored a legislation. I think I testified with Senator Wieger. I think we had a very similar bill regarding trying to lower that veterans' unemployment rate. But I do have a question. You know, these contracts and these intellectual property rights are very highly structured contracts. And my concern is, not a concern, I guess just something to take into account is, my fear is if we were to make this exemption just for veterans regarding intellectual property rights, I would not want it to make it less likely that a veteran would actually be employed or be contracted by this firm, whatever firm it is, because of these special intellectual property rights that belong to veterans. We don't want to make it so that it would be less likely that a veteran would be employed because the intellectual property contracts would be different for an employee than they would be for others. And that's just a caution that I submit.
Right. But we're asking to release things they don't want anyway. Your point is taken, but company is already decided not to use the invention before they give it up, so it's done voluntarily by the company.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Is that beyond the 6 months? I just saw the 6-month timeline. that it had to be used within 6 months. Yeah. Is that what you mean they've decided not to do it, or is there other pieces in the legislation here I'm missing?
Mr. Knepper?
That's the period to decide if they can't sit on any longer than 6 months.
Oh, okay.
Because the economy is moving along fast. I'd like to explain what I went through personally. I graduated from a one-room schoolhouse all the way through to an engineering degree, and I found out that the more education I had, the less freedom I had to use it. Unbelievable that that's going on today. So when I started working with my engineering degree in one big company making aerospace high-tech stuff, my brother-in-law, who's a dairy farmer, says, "Hey, Bob, why don't you use some of your government-supplied education to help us down here on the farm where I came from?" "What do you want?" He says, "I want an all-weather fence charger. Keep cows in. I don't want to go out and chase the cows when it's wet." So another fellow and I went to my basement shop, and we developed one. And using our own parts and materials and times and personal funds, and when we it worked better than we expected. And we took it to the Inventor Show that's financed by the state of Minnesota partially. And we got so much interest, and we had such a good demonstration that it drew a lot of interest. Anyhow, my employer discovered it at that show and claimed it. "What? You can't. I did this all on my own. It had nothing to do with what we're doing at work." "Well," he says, "that doesn't matter. Read your contract." Sure enough, it says in there, "The company owns whatever I did 24 hours a day, even at home." "What? I can't believe this." That started me on this 50-year mission to change the rules. And that's where I am today. Well, after negotiations with the company, they finally let me produce it. But they said, the company said it doesn't want to make it, but it required that I give the company a permanent royalty-free license to make, use, and sell it anywhere in the world, and to claim the same rights to all new improvements. Now, if you go and try and get funding for something with that kind of a anchor on it, if you want to call it that, it's hard enough to get funds to develop an ordinary product, but if you got to live under that. So that is really holding down a lot of new businesses and new jobs. I did get it on the market, and it's been on the market for 40 years. It raised the whole level of performance of all electric fence chargers. When I couldn't make a living on it, it's too small a product. It can be used with, it should be made with other products. So I guess that covers what I have to say. I'd love to answer any questions.
Certainly. Thank you very much, Mr. Knepper. We can tell you're very passionate about it, and Senator Wiegers worked hard on this on your behalf as well. I don't know if Ms. Larson wanted to add something briefly, and then we do need to kind of move on, committee members. We have one more bill that we need to get to yet today. But Ms. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I know that you're running late. I will be very brief. I did want to go on the record, though, that we do have some strong concerns about this proposal. The concern is that it will create a real chilling effect on businesses conducting research and development activities in the state. There's a lot of concern with the vagueness of the language. What does an invention mean? What does a proposal mean? What does substantial investment mean? I think there's potential for a lot of litigation around this. We certainly appreciate Mr. Knepper's concerns. I know some companies do have individual agreements that they enact with employees to alleviate some of these concerns. But our concern is that the bill as written now is would send a real negative message to companies wanting to do R&D in Minnesota. So I just wanted to make sure that we were on the record expressing that concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Any questions for Ms. Larson? Otherwise, Senator Wieger, any final thoughts?
No. Mr. Chair, members, we appreciate your thoughtful consideration. We know there is going to be some continued discussion on that. I salute Mr. Knepper's passion for this, and he's still out in the garage inventing.
That's great.
A part of Habitat for Humanity, everything, and he's just a real role model for inspiration. So we'll continue the dialogue. And on behalf of Mr. Knepper, we appreciate your consideration and knowing the frustration that an inventor may feel if a great idea is suffocated. Mm-hmm. I think there needs to be some liberation of thoughts, and it can equate to jobs.
Right.
I feel if this committee would pass this bill, it would be more valuable to our economy than the 4 years I spent in the Air Force.
Thank you very much, Mr. Knepper. Thank you, Senator Wieger. With that, I think we'll lay Senate File 714 over. Okay, members? Thank you very much, Senator Wieger. Thank you, Mr. Knepper.
Thank you.
Yep. Senator Schmidt, if you want to do this one. We've got one more bill.
All right, Senator Sparks, welcome to your committee here. We have Senate File 590 before us.
How come I always have to wait till last? Senate File 590, members and Chairman Schmidt, is an effort to address worker shortages in long-term care field. The bill takes a number of approaches to tackle this issue, including a grant program run by the Department of Employment and Economic Development and funding for targeted efforts at workforce centers across the state. In the essence of time, Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to turn it over to my two testifiers who will be able to fully explain the bill and answer any questions you may have. So with that, I'll just...
Ma'am, welcome to the committee. If you don't mind stating your name and proceeding.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Danielle Hochhalter. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at Leading Age Minnesota, and I'm here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'll just quickly go over the parts of the bill that pertain to this committee, and then I'll pass it over to Aaron to quickly describe why this bill is needed. So the sections that that pertain to this particular committee is Sections 7 through 9. Section 7 does target specific funding from DEED for grants related to the advancements of career in long-term care, such as providing funding to further employee education, go to conferences, hiring incentives, leadership training, mentorship models, and other advancement opportunities. Section 8 is a study through DEED that would look at the impacts of tax credits or hiring incentives on recruiting and retaining staff in long-term care. And Section 9 would enable providers to work with the workforce centers across Minnesota to address the shortages of caregivers in the field. They would go about addressing this shortage through the screening of potential candidates for jobs, promoting vacant positions, training individuals, and placement of those individuals as well.
Well, thank you, ma'am. Any questions at this stage? All right. Well, if you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding.
Sure. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Erin Bowie. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Care Providers of Minnesota, also here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I want to thank Senator Sparks for bringing this important bill forward. Minnesota is looking at 60,000 new seniors per year through the year 2030. In less than 5 short years, we will, for the first time, have more seniors than school children, and that trend does not change in the foreseeable future. Currently, long-term care facilities are facing a worker shortage. There are over 2,500 worker vacancies in nursing facilities across the state. Some facilities have the capacity to take more seniors in, but cannot do so because they don't have the staff to care for them. 1,500 admissions were denied last year due to insufficient staffing. The long-term care field hires a majority of nursing school graduates, but by the time the 18-month mark rolls around, most have left for jobs in hospital settings that can literally pay tens of thousands of dollars more. A couple of examples of the amount of turnover facilities are facing. The statewide average turnover for the CNA position sits at 51% per year. For RNs, it's 47%, and for LPNs, it's 40% a year. This type of turnover has obvious impacts on the seniors the employees care for, their families, and the facilities that employ them. The workforce challenges facing long-term care cannot be overstated. It is an issue we need to look at fixing now, as it is only going to continue to grow as the age wave hits Minnesota. Again, I want to thank Senator Sparks for bringing this bill forward. It is a strong first step in helping long-term care facilities to find better ways to recruit, train, and retain employees. Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. Members, any questions or comments, concerns? Senator Dames.
Thank you, Chair Schmidt. I don't have any questions, but I do have a comment. I think that it's a very good bill, and I thank Senator Sparks for bringing this forward, and it's something that we really need in our nursing home, something we need to be taking a look at and putting some money up to correct some of those issues. So thank you, Senator Sparks, for bringing this forward.
All right. Well, seeing no other questions or comments, Senator Sparks, would you like to say anything final?
Mr. Chair, no, I just thank Senator Deans for his comments. I think that this legislation is long overdue. We did have a hearing that was successful on health and human services, and hopefully we can get a positive vote here and send it on to finance to try to get some money to go along with this program.
Very well. Well, Senator Sparks, so would you like to move that Senate File 590 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance?
So moved.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And members, that brings us to a conclusion for today, and the meeting is adjourned.
Sorry to make you wait.